our window of opportunity may be closing, and we must address this in-state energy need for Alaska and businesses and consumers now.
Senator Mark Begich says the national clean energy focus may be right for the proposed gas pipeline. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, the 22nd of March. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, dozens of musk ox die in a drowning event on the Seward Peninsula.
They got caught in that rising water and drowned and are now frozen in the ice and snow.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. If you are an individual owner of Indian Trust land, an IIM account holder, or heir to an Indian Trust landowner or account holder, you may be eligible to receive money from a $3.4 billion federal settlement. To get a detailed written notice about the settlement that explains your legal rights, you may visit IndianTrust.com or call 1-800-961-6109. This message is sponsored by the Native American Trust.
U.S. Senator Mark Begich is calling for a federal coordinator for the Arctic Outer Continental Shelf. In a speech to the Alaska legislature today, Begich said he plans to introduce legislation next week to create the office modeled after Alaska's federal gas pipeline coordinator. KTOO's Casey Kelly has more.
Begich says an Arctic OCS coordinator would help develop oil and gas offshore, as well as in the National Petroleum Reserve Alaska and the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. The office would work across federal permitting agencies, the EPA, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, and the Interior Department, that Begich says are causing heartburn for Alaska today.
The federal OCS coordinator would work with the state of Alaska and the affected local governments to streamline development in the Chukchi in the Beaufort Sea, which holds such promise to the future of oil and gas development.
He says his bill would also allow the creation of federal coordinators for offshore development in the lower 48. Begich told state lawmakers Alaska is well positioned to influence Arctic policy and should seize opportunities in the region. He said he's already reached out to President Obama to cut red tape standing in the way of development.
The president's climate czar recently left her job, apparently correctly reading the tea leaves that cap-and-trade legislation is not happening. Along with that, I asked the president to replace the climate czar with a development czar to help focus the administration on the right priorities to our nation on producing American energy from American soil with American workers.
He says the national focus on clean energy should be good news for Alaska's proposed natural gas pipeline, but he says the state must act quickly.
I know you are waiting for a new report on an in-state gas line, the results of an open season, but from my perspective, I urge you not to wait too long. Our window of opportunity may be closing, and we must address this in-state energy need for Alaska and businesses and consumers now.
Meeting with reporters after the speech, Begich clarified that he supports both an in-state gas line and a line to the lower 48. But he says the in-state line is needed now to provide reliable energy and stimulate Alaska's economy.
Because if you don't have in-state, you can ship all the gas you want to lower 48, but if there's nothing happening here economically.
Begich says the state needs to act fast because of competition from other states where oil and gas exploration has increased in recent years. But unlike Senator Lisa Murkowski, who last month urged state lawmakers to approve Governor Sean Parnell's proposed tax cuts for oil and gas companies, Begich says only small incentives are needed to spur development. In his speech, he mentioned small, independent producers and international companies partially owned by European countries.
It doesn't take a lot of money, but just enough that they can, if it's grant or loan or combination that they can seed off of, I think that's a huge opportunity sitting out there.
Most members of Congress are in their home districts this week. Begich expects the climate in Washington to be more favorable to Alaska development when members return.
Because they're going to come back and they're going to have their heads beaten in by their constituents on price of oil for their heating, price of gasoline for their car, energy costs for their power for their house. They're going to hear this. And so for us, it's a huge opportunity right now.
Begich also encouraged state lawmakers to invest some of the state's surplus in Alaska-based high-tech industries and technologies, which could leverage federal and private funds. This was Begich's third speech to the legislature since he took office in 2009. In Juneau, with help from Rosemarie Alexander, I'm Casey Kelly.
Senator Mark Begich says Alaska military bases are not being targeted for major budget cuts. Instead, the Obama administration is recommending increased spending in the state. Begich told state lawmakers today that Alaska is recognized as a strategic post in the nation's world obligations and domestic security. Defense is a significant portion of the federal budget, and Begich says there will be reductions. But while some bases are being downsized and closed, he believes military spending in Alaska will be strong.
On the president's budget for 2012, without any ads from us at this point, is almost $400 million of construction investment into the military in Alaska. That's a huge statement.
Begich, who sits on the Senate Armed Services Committee, says the congressional delegation has worked hard to influence program spending, including defense.
Clear Air Force Base, those up in the interior, we will see in Clear Air Force Base probably over the next 5 years, $200+ million of investment. So in a lot of ways, we have kind of arrived in our position as a global security point for the country.
With Alaska having the largest open airspace in the country, Begich says it will be used more and more to test unmanned and other military aircraft. At least 32 musk ox died in Bering Land Bridge National Preserve on the Seward Peninsula last month during an unusual tidal event that sent water surging into an area that is usually dry land. But biologists don't expect the mass die-off to have any long-term impacts on the population. APRN's Any Fight reports.
A biologist discovered the grim scene last week on a routine flight to track four muskox that were collared for a research project. The 32 dead animals were visible as small brown humps poking out of the frozen landscape. When they died, the animals were in an especially low-lying area during an especially high tide. John Quinley is a spokesperson for the National Park Service. He says the die-off happened during a bad storm.
They got caught apparently in kind of a storm surge, a particularly high tide event in late February, and the water came up several feet over a fairly short period of time. And the assumption is that they got caught in that rising water and drowned and are now frozen in the ice and snow.
The dead animals were part of a group of 55 muskox. Biologists think the remaining 23 animals may have also died, but are buried deeper in the ice. The muskox belong to a herd on the Seward Peninsula that includes over 1,000 animals. And Quinley says that means on a population scale, the incident is not particularly significant.
It's not a population-threatening event.
Mass die-offs among animals are not uncommon. Quinley says groups of wolves and caribou are sometimes killed in large avalanches. And he says a few years ago, dozens of muskox on the North Slope died in another drowning event.
Ice dam in a river broke and in the spring, and you had a lot of water heading downstream, and similar numbers, 30 or more, died in that flood. But it's unusual to have had them radio collared and observed in just a week or two before the event. I mean, we know the sequence of events better than other incidents where you might just come across several carcasses in the spring.
The four collared muskox were part of a five-year study looking at the population dynamics of the animals in northwest Alaska. Now the dead muskox will help biologists learn even more about how the animals are doing. Quinley says researchers are planning to return to the site in late spring to gather samples as the muskox thaw out.
They'd be looking at teeth to determine their age, and also taking some bone samples that would look at sort of more general health, how fat they were, how well fed, how healthy they were. What we find out from this group that died will help us understand more about the herd in general in the area.
In the meantime, Quinley expects the muskox carcasses to feed lots of other animals in the area, including foxes, bears, and wolverines. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a unique learning opportunity washes up on shore near Sitka.
It's one of the special things that kids almost nowhere else in the world really have access to.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Quitting tobacco is the best thing you can do for your health. Join a free program that will help you create an easy-to-follow plan to quit. It will show you how to get ready, take action, and then live the rest of your life as a non-smoker. Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line provides 8 weeks of patches, gum, or lozenges, and quit coaches that are trained to address Alaskans, including expectant mothers. There's more information at 1-800-QUIT-NOW or visit AlaskaQuitLine.com. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line. It's free, it's confidential, and it works.
A company based in Maine is several years into a preliminary study of the viability of generating electric power using the strong tides in Cook Inlet. At a meeting in the city of Kenai this morning, Ocean Renewable Power Company outlined their general strategy for moving forward. KDLL's Ben Stanton reports.
If you've ever seen the wheat-cutting farm equipment, the combine, imagine the front of that machine, except bigger, and the blades are twisted into a slight spiral. That's roughly what the TGU looks like. That's the turbine generator unit that sits under the water and turns slowly with moving water.
So the output varies with the velocity of the current. So on an average basis, we're generating about 75% of the time.
Ocean Renewable Power President and CEO Chris Sauer says the advantage is that tides are somewhat predictable compared to something like wind. Also, the TGUs are designed to be able to link together with other TGUs to build a network that reduces the effects of the slowdown in between tides. But it's still not a perfect system for electrical supply. During his presentation, Sauer explained that the company does not expect to displace oil and gas. He calls tidal energy a small part of a diverse energy supply, but one that makes sense, he says, given the ongoing decline of oil and gas in Cook Inlet.
There's a lot of underutilized industrial capacity. Just drive out to Nikiski, you'll see that. There are fabrication facilities that are not being utilized. This is part of the whole value proposition that tidal energy brings.
Sauer says along with the preliminary test unit that was built and operated in Maine, several different designs are possible now, like a smaller unit design that would go into a river. That's what the company is exploring in the village of Nenana. If a project in Cook Inlet were to move forward, maintenance would need to be done about every year, and every 5 or 6 years, it would be replaced with another unit for enough time to take it out for more major repair. Sauer says besides bearings and seals, the structure itself is not going to wear out very quickly. He says there's really only one moving part.
When you think about it, there's nothing really that's going to wear out. The structure itself isn't going to wear out. So we think, certainly a 20-year life, but we can't find a component that says, hey, it's only going to last so long, particularly if every 6 years you're rebuilding the generator.
Most of the dozen or so in attendance today seem to be generally in support of at least exploration of tidal energy. The company is doing research now at Fire Island, west of Anchorage, where tidal power is a possibility. But questions remain. How will these generators affect wildlife like salmon and Cook Inlet beluga whales? The Fire Island research is examining exactly those issues and making them available to the public. U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service Field Supervisor Doug Palmer from the Soldotna office says the studies that Ocean Renewable Power is conducting will turn out useful information for many agencies.
That's the thing about Upper Cook Inlet. We don't understand how the salmon, we know it's an important migration corridor, probably not used heavily as a feeding area just because of the heavy turbidity and water clarity up there. It's more conducive for salmon to feed elsewhere other than Upper Cook Inlet. So it hasn't been studied well as far as where the fish are migrating, whether it's near shore, near the surface, or the bottom. And so I'm interested to see some of the findings that they have come up with.
And the Homer-based nonprofit Cook Inlet Keeper is supportive of tidal power. Executive Director Bob Shavelson says the concerns about tidal power are overshadowed by concerns in other industries.
I hear questions raised by certain federal and state agencies about impacts, and I think it's important to look at relative impacts from oil and gas seismic work or, Port of Anchorage expansion and understand that this is going to be a blip compared to some of those impacts. So we're hopeful that they'll get a fair hearing and this can move forward and that the pilot will grow into something more substantial.
Ocean Renewable hopes to provide power systems to others and to produce power themselves for electricity sales to local utilities. Meantime, state and federal regulatory agencies must approve steps along the way for it to proceed to a full-scale operation. In Kenai, I'm Ben Stanton.
Gooey ducks are known in Chinese culture as elephant trunk clams because of their elongated necks, which can grow to more than 3 feet. Farming of the strange-looking clam with a funny name is an $80 million a year industry in British Columbia and Washington State, where gooey ducks grow wild. Now, Homer Representative Paul Seaton would like to see them grown in communities along the Gulf of Alaska. KBBI's Aaron Selbig reports.
House Bill 60 is Representative Paul Seaton's third attempt to push through legislation allowing for the farming of gooey ducks in coastal communities on the Gulf of Alaska. The very large burrowing clams already grow wild in some parts of southeast Alaska and are farmed for profit in British Columbia and Washington State, where they currently sell for about $15 a pound. Seaton would like to see the same sort of economic boost in Gulf communities.
It's got great potential for private individuals and coastal communities and villages around, I think, the Gulf of Alaska.
Seaton says the impetus of the bill comes from the Aleutic Pride Shellfish Hatchery in Seward, the only facility in Alaska that supplies gooey duck seed. Because of fish and game regulations that prohibit the farming of a species in an area where that species does not already grow wild, potential gooey duck farmers in the Gulf of Alaska were prevented from getting permits, and the hatchery had few buyers for its gooey duck seed. Seaton says it took a lot of convincing, but fish and game officials now approve of his bill.
There's no known diseases. They're in muddy bottoms so that they won't be in the same habitat that would be other clam species that are utilized, such as razor clams. They're on a high-energy beach or hard-shell clams, which are on a cobble beach. These are in muddy bottoms, and there's no known conflict. We're not taking an animal that doesn't exist within the same, pretty much identical ecosystem except for water temperature. I think everybody has now done enough analysis and research and all that they're pretty confident that this could provide a new economic base for coastal Alaska communities without having much potential for unintended consequences.
It's thought that Gulf of Alaska waters are too cold for gooey ducks to breed, but not too cold for them to survive.
You know, their native range is from Washington up through British Columbia and southeastern. So even though they're not going to be a breeding population, that's just fine for a farmer. And so we shouldn't have any material conflicts between a wild stock that doesn't exist and a farm product.
The bill would open gooey duck farming only in Gulf of Alaska communities and only in subtidal areas.
We wanted to make sure that the bill was going to avoid any possible conflicts with subsistence use or where people go sport harvesting of clams and where they land their boats and all that kind of stuff, as well as the problem of the further north you go, you can have, you get freezing on the beaches and all. So you avoid that potential of mortality and things as well.
House Bill 60 now heads to the Senate, where Seaton expects hearings to be scheduled in the near future. In Homer, I'm Aaron Selbig.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. Northern Air Cargo. For over 54 years, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come. And by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the Trans-Alaska Pipeline with over 700 employees.
The State of Alaska Department of Revenue reminds you to file online now for your 2011 PFD and consider sharing a portion with your favorite charity through Pick, Click, Give. More information at pfd.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska.
Sitka students will likely be among those benefiting from the remains of a killer whale found dead on the shore of Kruzoff Island, about 10 miles east of Sitka. A team of scientists and volunteers performed a necropsy on the young male orca and recovered its skeleton on Friday. KCAW's Ed Ronco went along and has the story.
It's a mile and a half walk from our drop-off point at Fred's Creek to the whale carcass near Inner Point. I'm traveling with the second wave of the necropsy team. When we arrive at the worksite just before 11 a.m., the first team already has detached the whale's head and cut open one side of its body. They're starting to remove organs.
Urinary bladder, 4 pieces frozen, 1 for histo.
Dr. Stephen Raverty is a veterinary pathologist and head of pathology for the Provincial Veterinary Diagnostic Lab in Abbotsford, British Columbia.
Left testes, frozen in histo.
Whole.
No, cut in half.
Cut in half.
The killer whale carcass is on its side, with bright red flesh exposed to the open air. The intestines look like a pink fire hose coiled up inside the body. And yes, the smell is strong, a sour, spoiled odor that seems to cut through the air in invisible channels. For a necropsy rookie like me, 2 steps to the right or left can be the difference between smelling the fresh ocean air or choking on the stench. If the smell is bothering Raverty, he doesn't show it. He's kneeling next to the carcass. His hair is sweaty, and his waterproof overalls and gloves are covered in blood. He and other members of the necropsy team work quickly, racing against a rising tide. Eventually, the carcass is tied off with some green rope to prevent it from being carried away by the waves, which crash against the rocks, soaking some of the necropsy team. Raverty sits on a log long enough to explain what he's learned so far.
This animal does have a low-grade infection in its abdominal cavity. It has a fibrinous peritonitis. In people, it would be just a severe stomach pain or abdominal pain. And essentially, it would be an infection of the organs, the lining of the organs within the abdominal cavity.
Raverty says finding out what role that might have played in the whale's death will require more tests and some serious time in front of a microscope. The data will be included in an ongoing survey of stranded killer whales worldwide. Raverty says around the globe, more than 250 animals have been documented so far. A short distance away, a smaller team is trying to get tissue off the skull so it can be transported back to Sitka.
At which point we'll freeze it and then we'll take the rest of the meat off. But the more we can get off now, the less we have to carry. So it's actually out of convenience that we're doing this.
Shannon Atkinson is a professor in the School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences for the University of Alaska Fairbanks. She's based at the school's Juno Center. Her role in this is to recover the whale's skeleton, which will be used as part of a class she leads.
It's one of the special things that kids almost nowhere else in the world really have access to, the kinds of natural resources that we do up here.
As morning turns into afternoon, the skull gets cleaner and the carcass gets smaller. Up away from the tide, Dr. Rachel Juba is trying to get a tissue sample from the lungs. She's using a knife to score them across the top like a loaf of bread.
You might take a cut here and go, well, that looks pretty normal.
Oh, right, but somewhere else it might not be.
Exactly. So bread loafing is, and it would help if I had a sharper knife, but bread loafing, you're just taking small sections, and then you can actually look at the tissue in each section.
That's nice lung tissue.
Juba is a veterinarian representing the Alaska Sea Life Center. She has a lot of experience performing necropsies on a lot of different species.
This is my first orca. I've been out on several humpback whales, many other marine mammals, stellar sea lions, harbor porpoise, a lot of harbor seals, but never an orca. It's a pretty rare find around here.
The rareness of this find translates into important opportunities for the scientists on scene to see how the whale is put together, to take samples back for analysis, and for Atkinson from UAF to offer more opportunities for students in Sitka and elsewhere. On the eastern shore of Kruzoff Island, near Sitka, I'm Ed Ronco.
A new Heidelberg nonprofit is in the works to promote the Haida language and culture, as well as educational opportunities in the Prince of Wales community. KRBD's Deanna Garrison has the story.
In recent years, Haidas have seen the number of fluent Haida speakers dwindle to an alarmingly low level. At the same time, community members are worried that children are becoming less connected to their native culture. In hopes of reversing that trend, Haida residents have formed a nonprofit. Lisa Lang is executive director of XKKF, or Hadas Kil Qiyaz.
The community sat down, the tribe sat down, and tried to look at ways to address the fact that our elders are dying, our language was passing on, and there was just this imminent concern.
She says the number one priority of the new nonprofit will be to preserve and expand use of the Haida language. To that end, the nonprofit has hired Ben Young, who was brought on as a HIDA specialist.
What we're trying to do is trying to spark the interest. We'd like to bring up more leaders. We'd like for them to learn their native language. We'd like for them to speak it. We'd like for them to speak it on a daily basis. And we'd like them to influence others as well, almost have a ripple effect.
Young says the HIDA language is in danger of being lost if new steps aren't taken to educate new speakers.
Right now, at this current state, we have just a few fluent speaking elders. Actually, you could really, as far as Alaskan dialect goes, you could probably count them on one hand. We had just lost one prominent advocate, Irma Lawrence.
I got up Irma's memorial dinner, and I wanted them to know that the language will continue. There was a deep concern for the loss of the language, and so to the family, we expressed that our community will continue to promote that.
Language classes will also be part of the community's culture camp, which takes place each July. Lang says continuation of the culture camp will be another priority of the nonprofit.
We're trying to show what we're trying to save, what we're trying to preserve and promote. And there's so many classes. There's carving, there's jam making.
The culture camp also features a talking circle and canoeing, as well as sketching, weaving, and singing classes, among other things. In addition to promoting the HIDA language and culture, Lang says XKKF is hoping to provide expanded educational opportunities for HIDA youth through a new higher education scholarship program.
Basically, it's to supplement their higher education because there's never enough money for we've found that out. And we found that these part-time scholarships, the one-time scholarships, just aren't doing it. So we tried to vision what would look as successful, and it is. When it's funded, it would be a larger grant that would include funding the schooling.
Lang says scholarship recipients would be asked to return to Heidelberg and participate in culture camp. The Heidelberg Cooperative Association is supporting the formation of the nonprofit, which will ultimately be an independent entity. In Ketchikan, I'm Deanna Garrison.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Casey Kelly and Rosemarie Alexander in Juneau, Ben Stanton in Kenai, Aaron Selbig in Homer, Ed Ronco in Sitka, and Deanna Garrison in Ketchikan. Our editor and producer is Annie Fite. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
First National Bank Alaska, serving Alaskans' financial needs for nearly a century. Member FDIC, equal housing lender.
And by
Crowley, providing tanker escorts, fuel delivery, and energy support services to Alaskans for over 50 years. From Valdez to the North Slope, Crowley knows Alaska. Crowley.com.
The University of Alaska now offers both a Bachelor of Science and a Bachelor of Arts degree in fisheries. Begin your UAF Fisheries degree at any major University of Alaska campus and finish in Fairbanks or Juneau. Learn more at www.uaf.edu/fish. The UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences, educating fisheries and marine science experts in Alaska for Alaska. This message sponsored by the UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences. No other port in Alaska is building a 100 rail car loop like the one going in at Port McKenzie. Exporting natural resources from rail to ship will be more efficient than ever. A single limestone deposit in the interior could mean a cement industry in Alaska. Port McKenzie Rail, hundreds of millions in state revenues, thousands of jobs. This message sponsored by the Matanuska-Susitna Borough.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.